Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Award-winning novelist Gail Brandeis is the keynote speaker on brave writing for this year's WordSpring at Butte College. She teaches at Sierra Nevada College and Antioch University, Los Angeles, and will be at Butte College on April 25th. She is author of a memoir, The Art of Misdiagnosis, and most recently a novel in poems about the most prolific female serial killer in history. In this novel, Many Restless Concerns, the victims of Countess Bathory speak in chorus, a testimony. Gail Brandeis gives voice to the hundreds of girls and women killed by this Countess of Hungary between 1585 and 1609. Gail Brandeis, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we tackle your novel about an infamous female serial killer, I'd like to ask you about your memoir, The Art of Misdiagnosis.
Of course.
How did this come about?
This memoir is centered around my mother's suicide. She took her own life in 2009, 1 week after I gave birth to my youngest son. And writing is how I make sense of my life. It's how I make sense of myself and the world around me. And I knew as soon as my mom died, I would have to write about it. I didn't know if I'd have to write about it just for myself or if it would be a book that I would want to put into the world. But I knew that writing would be my best chance of making peace with the trauma of her death, with kind of trying to understand my history of my relationship with her. And I'm so grateful that I have writing as a way to process, because writing the book very much was an act of healing for me. I started writing this book with a lot of anger toward my mom. I was in such a vulnerable place, having just given birth when she took her own life. And I found myself just, you know, really angry, which is a very common response to a suicide, I learned. I've since done a lot of work around suicide prevention and helping other suicide loss survivors, and anger is very common as a response to that kind of loss. But I found that the more I wrote about her and the more I wrote about our relationship and the way she ended her life, the more I was able to develop compassion for her. And I hope I would have gotten to that place even without writing, but I think that the writing really allowed me to kind of burn through my anger toward a place where I felt that compassion. And compassion is, it's harder than anger to deal with, because it's a more painful emotion, but it also feels better even though it's painful. And my heart opened up to her, and I just found it such a healing process. And I've been really gratified to learn that readers have found it healing as well. I've heard from a lot of suicide loss survivors, as well as people who've lost loved ones in other complicated ways or just have a complicated grief. And I've found that by sharing my story, it has empowered other people to share theirs, which has been so meaningful to me, because for way too long, this kind of loss has been kept in the shadows. It hasn't been talked about enough. And there's been a real stigma around it. And people have told me that their families had told them not to talk about the suicide in their family because it was embarrassing or it would bring shame upon the family. But my feeling is that it's the silence that perpetuates the stigma and perpetuates the shame. And it's when we speak about these things that we can help disperse that stigma, can help break through it. And I think the more we can talk about these things, the more people can get help, the more we can prevent suicides from happening if we talk about it more. So I'm grateful that my book has opened the door for conversation and for storytelling for others.
My guest is novelist and poet Gail Brandeis, and I've asked her about her memoir, been described as wrenching, memoir, entitled The Art of Misdiagnosis, Surviving My Mother's Suicide. And a lot of times people who are going to commit suicide give hints. It sounded like, the little I know, that this just was a bolt out of the blue because it was so startling how she committed suicide and where she committed suicide.
Yes, she really had not given us clues, and which definitely made it all the more shocking. She took her own life in a very random place, a parking garage of an apartment building that she had no connection with. And just earlier that day, she had actually, the letter she had written to me and my sister was asking us to give her more time. She had an undiagnosed delusional disorder and believed that our father was hiding millions of dollars from her, was trying to poison her, and all of these horrible things. Our father was the kindest, most generous person, so it was very hard to hear her talk about him that way. But she wanted to time to build her case against him. She thought if she could do her research and get to a safe place, she could do this. And we were putting together a psychiatric evaluation team to meet her. She had run away. It's a long story. You'll have to read my book to get the whole thing. But
well, her research took the form of a documentary about the rare illnesses she thought were in her family. And in fact, the title of your book, The Art of Misdiagnosis, was the title of her documentary.
It was. I borrowed the title of her documentary for this project, and it means a very different thing when I use it than when she used it. She used it sort of as a play on words because the documentary was very much about her own artwork, her paintings. She had this 40-day kind of rush of creativity in her 60s where all of a sudden she started painting about her family, and she had been estranged from her family, but she felt as if the spirits of her family were coming through and telling these stories of medical malfeasance and just their undiagnosed illnesses. I actually have one of her paintings on my wall. I'm looking at it right now. And so this documentary she was using her paintings to tell the story of these diseases that were thought to be rare diseases, but she thought they were just rarely diagnosed. Interestingly, Ehlers-Danlos, which is one of the diseases she believed was in our family, is potentially being declassified as a rare disease, away from being a rare disease, for the same reason that she thought that it's rarely diagnosed, but it's not rare. She would be so happy if she knew that this was happening now. She would feel so vindicated.
You mentioned porphyria.
Yes.
I had heard of it, but I had not heard of this syndrome that you just were mentioning.
Yeah, Ehlers-Danlos is a connective tissue disorder, which is suddenly kind of in the public eye now. More and more people, I know several friends actually who have been diagnosed with it. And at the time she was making the documentary, it was really a very little known disorder. And so I decided to take the title because I thought it worked on different levels when I used it, because she was never diagnosed her own mental illness. And I've dealt with my own misdiagnosis in my own life of physical things. And it played on different levels when I used it. So I stole her title. I think that people have asked me how she would feel about me writing this book, and that question at first was a really hard one to hear because I thought, oh, she would be so mad. But then I came to realize, no, she would be delighted to have her face on a book cover. She was someone who craved the spotlight, and I think ultimately if she was in her best frame of mind, if she wasn't in the throes of one of her delusions, I think she would see the love that this book was written with. And it was truly written with so much love. And it is very much a love letter to her, even though it covers a lot of painful stuff, and it doesn't always show her in the best light. I think it ultimately shows her for the amazing, creative, visionary person she was. And I hadn't been able to see how incredible she was in life, I think, which makes me sad. And I know, we probably would have had a better relationship had I been able to fully see her creativity and see what an amazing woman she was. But I'm grateful that writing the book allowed me to see her more clearly, and I would hope that she would appreciate that.
In fact, you say that you and your mother had misdiagnosed one another.
Yes. Yeah, we, I think it can be hard for people that are close to each other to see one another clearly, and we projected all sorts of things onto each other, and our relationship was definitely a complicated one, and I wish that we had been able to see each other more clearly and had been able to meet each other where we truly were instead of projecting all sorts of things on one another. But I feel so much closer to her now, having written this book, and that gives me a great deal of peace, which I'm incredibly grateful for.
In fact, from what you've been saying, it sounds like the book would be a downer, but you do say that this Tangled Mysteries of Disease, Mental Illness, and Suicide, and it comes out the other side with grace.
It's important to me for my books to be hopeful, even when they go into painful areas. I think that this book is ultimately a healing book, a hopeful book. For me, breaking silences is a very hopeful act, and I had to break so many of my own silences with this memoir. With the new book, Many Restless Concerns, I was breaking in historical silence, and I don't know if you're ready to shift into that.
Oh, yeah, but exactly. Yeah. This is a transition to your more recent work, which is a novel in poetry form.
Yes, yes. And this is a book I actually started writing before my mom's death. While I was pregnant with my son, my daughter was a teenager at the time. My two older kids were 19 and almost 16 when the little one was born. And my daughter was really interested in notorious women of history and would ask for books about women pirates and other women outlaws. And she had requested this one book that had different chapters about different notorious women. And I found it fascinating too. And so I was thumbing through it and happened upon this chapter about Countess Bathory, who I had not been familiar with. And when I learned about all the fact that she had silenced so many girls and women, I found myself really haunted by this. And I started doing research, and there's so much written about the Countess herself. She's been the subject of a variety of novels and movies and various things, but her victims were treated in a very secondary way, and there was nothing that centered their stories. And I found myself really haunted by them, and I felt this need to give them voice. And so I started doing research. I started writing. But it is, it's dark, intense material, and it felt like maybe it wasn't quite the right thing to be writing while pregnant. And so I set it aside. And then my mom died, and then that's what I had to write about. And when I finished writing The Art of Misdiagnosis, I felt so lost as a writer because it really felt like the book I was born to write. It felt so urgent and necessary. And even though I've been writing my whole life, I started writing when I was 4 years old, I wondered whether I would ever write again because it felt as if there would never be a project that would feel as urgent as necessary. And so I just was kind of drifting creatively. And then I remembered this Bathory project I had set aside, and I opened up my files And I found myself so compelled by it again. And it really felt like the perfect project to kind of dive into after the memoir. Because it was, again, you know, going from breaking my own silences to breaking a larger silence to dealing with a larger grief than my own, and to try to find some light within that to create hope. You know, of course, these girls and women had lost their lives, but in speaking together, they're able to gain power together, they're able to find agency together, and they're able to really create their own justice. And the writing started to feel like an act of justice to me. It had felt that way before, even, you know, when I was pregnant too, but it felt even more urgent. And then it happened to coincide too, as I was writing it again, with the Me Too movement and women raising their voices en masse. And so it began to have more of a resonance with the present day as well. And I thought about how, even though this is historical, there are still girls and women who are disappearing and, you know, tragically being killed in huge numbers, especially in the Indigenous communities. And so I was really grateful to have this project as a way to find my voice again, and in the process give voice to people who have been voiceless for centuries.
My guest is award-winning novelist and poet Gail Brandeis. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Gail Brandeis, author of Many Restless Concerns. So to give listeners an idea of what your poem is like, Gail, I'd like you to start at the beginning. And the first line, they say she bathed in our blood. And right away, because you just start right in the middle, we figure, okay, they just people. She, we know, is the countess, and our blood. So this poem is in the first person.
Yeah, first person plural. Yeah, I felt as if I wanted to give these girls and women a collective voice, and every once in a while a single voice comes out to tell her own story, but mostly they speak together.
Because the word chorus is in your title.
Yes.
The victims of Countess Bathory speak in chorus.
Yes. They say she bathed in our blood. They say it brightened her complexion, our iron and salt scouring her skin of impurities, a bleach better than arsenic. Or so you've heard, or so everyone's heard. You've imagined her body a luminous petal in all that crimson. Hundreds of us bled for her beauty, scores of us drained so she could glow. If this were true, we wouldn't still hover here, still haunt. If our blood had seeped into her skin, we could have flowed directly into her heart, tried to dampen its vicious thirst. But our blood was ignored, swabbed from marble floors, left to sink into hard-packed soil. Our blood, our dear and wasted blood, our blood has trapped us here. You want to know how we died. That's all anyone wants to know, the harsh circumstance of our death. We will tell you. It's part of who we are, part of how we are. But if that's all you want to know, don't waste our time. Leave now. Take your bloodlust elsewhere. We want you to know how we lived, that we lived, that we were girls before we were game, that we were alive. We were alive. We were alive. That we are still waiting for the release she thought she had given us.
This is author and poet Gail Brandeis, and she's reading from her recent novel in poetry form, and the title is Many Restless Concerns, The Victims of Countess Bathory Speak in Chorus, A Testimony. That's quite a long title, but it is unlike anything I think most of us have ever encountered, what you have created. It's very inventive, Gail, what you have
Thank
written
you.
Here. Now, the this Countess Bathory of Hungary, and that's a part of the world that has shifted so many times, the borders between countries, that it's hard in my imagination to keep these straight. And we're talking about a period of time that's quite some time ago, back in the 16th century, this Countess in Hungary. So that contributes, I think, to the mystery.
Yes, and it is very mysterious. I think no one knows for sure why she did what she did. And, you know, my thought is it's probably a mixture of mental illness and power run amok. And, you know, she was taught that she, you know, she needed to keep her servants in their place by her in-laws. So it was kind of culturally appropriate to be abusive toward the servants, but she took it to a whole new horrible level. And of course, it started out horrible.
Well, you give her background, and I assume that a lot of that you took from the historical records.
Yes.
For example, that she was sent to live with a Nadushdi at age 12. So she could learn before she got married, just 2 years after that. Age 14, she got married?
She did, yes.
And so do you have page 26? Could you read us that page,
yes.
Gail?
Yes, yeah, I'd be happy to. The lady knew what it was like to leave home at a young age, sent to live with the Nadistis at 12 so she could learn the way of the estate before her wedding 2 years hence. Does that give you sympathy for her? Have it if you must. Have sympathy for poor, poor Erzsébet Báthory, who had sympathy for none but herself. She was an educated girl, more schooled than many princes. She could read Hungarian, Latin, German, maps. She could play the spinet, discuss issues of the day. She knew all the proper dances, all the ways to rouge one's cheek and pray to God. And she had fits, rages where she'd fall, scratch at her governess's eyes. The beast was alive in her from a tender age. Perhaps it was alive in the whole Bathory family. Perhaps that's why three wolf teeth slash across their coat of arms, three sharp and menacing points. Countess Nadasty taught her new things, how to stand for hours while girls like us hooked and tied her into her clothes, stained her lips with crushed beetles, dropped belladonna into her eyes to make them shine, applied wax to her hair so it would stay, how to hold court and send orders for cardamom to Vienna, how to manage hemp crops and write pleas to the king, how to plan a party, how to take the waters in Piastini, how to keep her servants in their place.
This is Gail Brandeis, and she's reading from her novel that's written in poetry form, and the title of this novel is Many Restless Concerns about this Countess in Hungary in the 16th century. Now, so much of this is quite specific about this, the things that she learned from this other countess. And I assume that most, if not all, of what you just read is factual.
Yes, I did a lot of research, and I love research. I find research so fascinating and so nourishing for me as a writer. And when I do research, I look for those really specific compelling details that will help bring the time period to life. So things like the fact that beetles were crushed to use as lipstick, and, you know, wax was used to tame the hair, things of that nature. I was hungry for details like that. And details where I could really put myself into that time period physically, so I could try to bring the physical reality of it to the page. So looking for not just facts and figures and things like that, but those really interesting sensory details that could help evoke the time period.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, as readers hear all these horrible things that happened to these girls and women, they wonder, well, why didn't they do something? Why didn't they rise up against this terrible woman? And there's a section in your book where you in their voice, you say, "We were handed needles and knives and sugar and coal, handed shovels and thimbles and arms full of clothing, handed thread and stew pots and seeds for the garden, handed candles and brooms and serving forks and saffron and scissors and pig's heads and wood for the fire, chamber pots. Had we the nerve and unity that we now share, we could have used these as tools to rise up against her." Now, did you get that, or is it part of that from your imagination, this long list of things that they were given to do?
That it was a mix of the two things. I did a lot of research into what servants did do at the time, what sorts of processes were used to clean, and what was necessary for the upkeep of a castle, as much as I could find. But I definitely had to use my imagination to fill in the blanks.
My guest, Gail Brandeis, her poetry, essays, and short fiction have been widely published in places like the New York Times and Oprah's Magazine. And her latest work is the one we were talking about right now, is the Many Restless Concerns, The Victims of Countess Bathory Speak in Chorus, A Testimony. And this is a protest against silence. Now, how did you get that across, that message across, Gail?
I think just the fact that these girls and women are speaking together after having been silenced, that in itself is a protest against silence. And truly, any time we set pen to paper, it's a protest against silence. Every time we speak, we are breaking through silences. But I feel like I got that across too in the way that they grow in power together over the course of the book, that they are able to realize that at some point there are enough of their voices that they can make things happen in the physical world. And for me, it's, you know, that's actually happening in the story, but it also felt metaphorical in terms of voices rising together to make a difference.
You make the point, too, that this Countess Erzsébet Báthory of Hungary was found guilty of killing as many as 650 girls and women between the years of 1585 and 1605. And the poem, we didn't go into the bloody parts, but readers can read that. But I would like to leave on a more positive note, if you don't mind,
sure,
Gail.
Sure, yes, of course.
Would you read page 37 for us?
Of course. We found little moments of comfort, moments when we could slip a scrap of bread beneath a cube of bacon roasting and catch its drippings, moments when we could pass poultices of comfrey or yarrow or burdock between us, take a breath or two of sweet relief, moments when we could look into each other's eyes even for a flash, And there were days, blessed days on end, when she was off at another estate or at court or the spa, days when her worst lackeys were not around to carry out her orders, and we could shape the marzipan however we wanted, or toast corn kernels to share as a treat, or take a moment to rest in our washing and look out the window, or linger in the herb garden, breathing in the marjoram and rosemary and tarragon. Times when we didn't need to worry if our aprons were straight, our hair perfectly in place. Times when we could rub our hands if they cramped during our sewing. Times when we could talk to one another, sometimes even laugh. Times when we could go out to the orchard and eat every pear we wanted.
Award-winning novelist and poet Gail Brandeis, thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful for this conversation.
After a break, I'll be talking to Chico author Alida Bryson about her book, It's All About Perspective. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. In her youth, former English teacher Alida Bryson faced many challenges and now shares her personal stories in a book to encourage others to view life challenges with a fresh perspective. Writing under the pen name Katie McVeigh, Alida Bryson hopes to help others heal from past trauma. She is a Reiki master trained in hospice and death and dying. Her book is It's All About Perspective. Change Your Perspective, Change Your Life. Alida Bryson, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, why were you willing to bare your soul, so to speak, and tell these stories?
I felt like it would, first of all, help myself and then reach out and perhaps touch somebody else. When I have clients coming into my office, I often realize that some of what I've gained or what I've learned through my life experiences might be helpful to them. And so I'm able to help them relax and move into healing, a healing state. And so I decided to go ahead and write just a few of my experiences in order to help somebody else perhaps understand that they're not alone, that they aren't the only ones that have gone through terrible, horrible things, or have experienced unique, beautiful, fantastic things that they don't really know how to deal with.
Now, I introduced you as Alida Bryson, but you write under a pen name, Katie McVeigh. And why did you choose to do that? To keep it a little more private?
To keep it a little more private. And I wanted to honor my family as well. Katie was my great-grandmother's first name. L is for the middle name of my mother who has passed, and her sisters are all have a middle name of Lee, and so that's what the L represents. And McVeigh, I'm a genealogist, amateur genealogist, and one of my great-great-grandmothers on my biological father's side, her maiden name was McVeigh. So I chose Katie L. McVeigh
as your pen name. And so that really is a family name.
Yes, it is.
So Alida Bryson, and she writes under the pen name Katie L. McVeigh. The title of her book, It's All About Perspective. Change Your Perspective, Change Your Life. Well, that sounds easy.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. The easy part anyway.
So if your book, say, It's All About Perspective, Change Your Perspective, Change Your Life. So Do you have tips for changing your one's perspective?
I do. You know, often when I'm looking at something, I'm say, for example, there's a little child who fell down, started to cry, and her little brother comes over and picks her up. And perhaps memories change, and she believes her little brother is the one who pushed her. And so getting her to recognize that that is a misbelief clears her of any anger or any bitterness she might hold, whether it's true or not, understanding that there was a reason behind what occurred. And if nothing else, it's to help us see ourselves as we are.
You actually have science on your side because we are learning how memories are not that reliable.
No, they're really not. I've got siblings. There are several of us, actually. And we each may remember an incident at a Christmas event that has a different twist to it. So it's kind of interesting to be able to listen to other people's perspectives of what occurred and your own, and realize there's truth in all of them.
In fact, one of your chapters is entitled that.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you use dreams to help yourself?
Well, when I first started taking psychology classes, sleep and dreams captured my attention because I have often several different dreams that are strange. And have realized through my classes how to go in and talk to various aspects of those dreams. And in doing so, I know that they don't exist. For example, talking to a Pegasus might be really strange. But in reality, it's part of who we are. We're tapping into that.
You mentioned Pegasus because that was one of your dreams.
Yes.
About this horse.
Yes, it was. And so you go in and you talk to whatever aspect is in your dream. Let's say that you have a dream about ants crawling on your countertop and eating your fruit. When you go back into a dream and you're looking at it from a different perspective and you talk to that ant and say, what is it you are trying to teach me? And what is it you're eating? And you've discovered they're eating perhaps the fruit or the vegetables. Maybe it's trying to tell you need to be enjoying some of the sweetness of life. And so when you go in and you look at the various aspects of a dream, it really does help you understand more of what you may need or what you need to release and let go of. Because if it's an irritant, let it go. If it's a pleasure, find more.
You know, I sometimes have found that relating a dream to another person, putting into words, mm-hmm. can a little light bulb go off your head. Oh, that's what that dream was about.
Exactly.
When you're telling the other person, the words come in a way that, oh, now I understand.
Yes.
So you, though, encourage people to write down their dreams.
Yes, I do. Write down your dreams and make note of what is prominent. If there's something repetitive, it's got a message for you. Look at it. If you need help, find somebody to help you. Like you said, your friend did. They discussed it with you and they were able to find their own answers. And so it's just a gift.
My guest is Olita Bryson, and she writes under the pen name Katie L. McVeigh. Her book is It's All About Perspective. Change Your Perspective, Change Your Life. And in the preface of your book, you kind of outline what you think are important lessons. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, truth is everywhere.
Yes.
And you say, I'm a seeker who enjoys searching for answers to perplexing questions or problems and have helped others walk through theirs. Another point you say, these are bullet points, death is not an ending but a continuation. Paranormal experiences are real. There is divine intervention. Spiritual gifts often run in families. Reincarnation is possible. And this one I found amusing, actually, Olita. Some angels' wings match their hair.
It does.
I've come across that in no other source, but that was your experience.
Yes, absolutely. It was my experience. In one of the stories that I write about, it's a past life experience, and it was very traumatic, and an angel came and carried me away. In that lifetime, I had killed myself, but I was a very young girl and had gone through horrible traumas and deaths, and I had hanged myself in a past life, and an angel came and wrapped me in his wings and took me high up above the mountains and said I was never to ever do anything like that again. And he told me many, many things. And so my experience of as to the wings matching the hair comes from my event with the beautiful, he was gigantic. He was not small. He held me in his arms like I was an infant and told me never to ever do something like that again.
To take your own life.
Never to take my own life again, ever.
Well, now, you just mentioned in passing reincarnation.
Yes.
And people say, hey, wait a minute. She's talking about past lives and reincarnation. And how long have you gone along with that, Alita? Always? Have you always believed in reincarnation?
No, actually, I did not. It was kind of one of those things with religion that you don't, that's just not something that's acceptable. But the more I thought about it and the more I experienced things and the more I saw with clients coming into my office and their ancestors are with them, it's like, oh, okay. And I had an event that I did not write in my book about seeing a crusader coming and telling me that my client was his son. And it was a woman on my table. So lots and lots of experiences have taught me that who am I to question what could possibly be true? If I'm open to accepting something odd or unusual, something that I would deny.
That you're not going to dismiss it out of hand.
I won't. I can't. My experiences have been as such that there are possibilities in every aspect of whatever happens in our lives. There are good things that can come from horrible things. There are so many people I know who are counselors who have been abused, and they are the best helpers for children who have needs. So for us to push aside a concept or something that is unpleasant as being taboo, we reject possibilities of growth, wisdom, and learning.
And you mentioned learning, and you say you feel that's why we're here. Mm-hmm. And you say in your, this just happened to be the end of your introduction, it took years for me to realize every experience has to do with the education of me.
Yes.
That these experiences are educating you.
Yes. Every experience we have gives us a grain of wisdom, warning, love, understanding who we are, what we will accept and what we will not accept. And those are the things that are very important for us to actually reach out and help humanity, help us find our humanity within ourselves.
My guest is Alita Bryson, writing under the pen name Katie L. McVeigh. It's all about perspective. Change your perspective, change your life. One of the things you mentioned in your bullet points at the beginning of your book, you say spiritual gifts often run in families.
Yes, it does. And I find that—
Now, what do you mean? Maybe you should explain what you mean by a spiritual gift.
Oh, spiritual gifts. For example, seeing the dead. Being communicated by them, with them rather. The spiritual gifts, such as knowing in advance something is going to happen and not maybe knowing why, or why you're told by spirit to do something until it comes to pass, those are all spiritual gifts that we have to help us reach out and help humanity. This is all about civilization. It's all about communication. It's all about helping one another.
Yeah. And since you say these spiritual gifts often run in families, I assume you're speaking from experience.
Yes.
That it runs in your family.
Yes, it does. My great-grandmother, and I write about this in the book, my great-grandmother, one morning I was sitting with her and she said, I saw your grandfather, your great-grandfather. I said, you did? And he said, yeah, he told me so. And she goes in to tell me all of the things he told her and that he had written her a song. And that's in the book. And then I went through to find the song I truly believe he wrote for her because of all the circumstances surrounding the song. And it meant so much to her. So spiritual gifts, my mother had it, my grandmother had it, my father had it. And like Luke would say, my sister had it, has it. So it does run in families.
Because I have heard stories, say from India, where this child says that he was my uncle in a past life, and the family dismisses it. Oh, you know, mm-hmm. You're just making this up. So you didn't have a family like that who doubted these experiences. When you had them, they say, well, yeah, this is a part of your spiritual gift that runs in our family.
Yes. They were very encouraging. And when I would tell my mom, I had a dream, Mom, she'd say, tell me about it. So I hope that somebody reading this book who may not have had receptive parents understand that they need to be more receptive for their own children, because chances are if they have it, so does somebody else in their family. Probably just not talked about.
You mentioned death and dying.
Yes.
And you say death is not an ending but a continuation.
Yes.
And that's part of, if you believe in reincarnation, then your spirit continues to live. How do you, if you explain, if somebody says, Alita, how do you know that? How do you know that death is not an ending? I mean, I have a friend who says, when you're dead, you're dead. They put your body in the ground. That's it.
Wait until you feel them go through you. And that's all I can tell you, that through dreams, through journeying with the Native Americans, through death and dying, and through having a friend that did that very thing, she went through me. And I felt such joy and such freedom from her. Seeing my sister, my little sister, I had a set of twin sisters and one of them passed away. And in a journey with a shamanic class, I saw her and talked to her in a journey. And she helped me understand some things and helped me help my family understand some things. So, yeah.
Do you have other suggestions for people who, as to how, because that's the title of your book. It's all about perspective. Change your perspective, change your life.
Yes. I think that when I realized that the way I perceived something and the way some people around me perceived them were completely different. And in order to understand truth, we need to grasp the essence of truth in each perspective, because people have a different belief structure, for example. But the thing that is in common is there is a higher being in all religions, in all belief structures. The shamanic way, they know that you can speak with spirits and you're guided by them. And you can journey and talk with them. Every aspect of cultures, except those who have forbidden anything like that to exist, it still does. It's just in the shadows. But every culture has something to do with being able to understand something we cannot see, something we cannot understand. There's a greater essence, if you will. It's like when you look at a soda bottle, clear, like a seltzer water bottle, the water looks like water. You shake it up, suddenly it's not water. There's a different perspective you need to look at. And when you look at it, you think it's water and you take a sip, whoa, that's a totally different opportunity to have another perspective. It looks the same. It looks pretty simple. But if you look from like a prismic, you know, a prism, you see something different each time you look at it. And that's what brings us wisdom and peace and the ability to have empathy for others instead of judgment. When we look at it and say, wow, something horrific must have happened to that guy for him to be so mean, or that gal for her to be so cruel. I wonder what's going on with that instead of, wow, what a cat, you know, or wow, what a mean person that is, or some other kind of nasty name. There's a reason that they're behaving that way, and we can't see it, but it's there. That's not who they really are, unless there's some kind of mental or emotional deficit.
My guest is Olena Bryson, and some people know her as a teacher. She was a former English teacher here in Chico. You say some people know you as a healer. And I'm imagining that some people that couldn't go along with some of these things you've been saying, Olita, you know, I can't believe, but if you made me feel better, if you helped me heal, then I'm going to go along with your program.
Right.
Thank you for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Olena Bryson, writing under the pen name Katie L. McVeigh. Her book is It's All About Perspective. Change Your Perspective, Change Your Life. And now here's Anthony Peyton Porter with a poem for us.
Now, this is something by Ernest Hilbert. And the title is Domestic Situation. Maybe you've heard about this. Maybe not. A man came home and chucked his girlfriend's cat in the wood chipper. This really happened. Dinner wasn't ready on time. A lot of other little things went wrong. He spat on her father, who came out when he learned about it. He also broke her pinky, stole her checks, and got her sister pregnant. But she stood by him, stood strong through it all, because she loved him. She loved him, you see. She actually said that, and then she went and married him. She felt some unique call. Don't try to understand what another person means by love. Don't even bother. And that was Domestic Situation by Ernest Hilbert. I'm Anthony Porter.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.